From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Greener, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, during the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with John Coquette, the Global Climate Policy Director of the Sierra Club. He'll talk with us about Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord and what the response and impacts have been, both here in the U.S. and abroad.
And in the second half, after 42 years on the endangered species list, the Yellowstone grizzly bear, whose numbers have grown to more than 700 from fewer than 150, will lose its protected status. This from the Interior Department announced last week.
In deciding to lift the protection, Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of the Interior, remarked, "This achievement stands as one of America's great conservation successes, the culmination of decades of hard work and dedication on the part of state, tribal, federal, and private partners."
But many, including Native American groups and those that study the Yellowstone grizzly, disagree. Matt Bishop is an attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center. He joins us in the second part of the show to discuss his concerns with this decision and why this action might signal the start of other bears and wildlife losing endangered species protection.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
G'day, it's Ian from Campos Coffee. Us Aussies really love a summer as much as we love supporting KPCW. We've got Nitro Cold Brew on tap, Affogato's made with Wasatch Creamery Ice Cream, and Mamachari Kombucha made with our Cascara Coffee Cherry. Located above the ice rink at Park City Mountain Resort next to the Adirondack Chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is John Coquette, the Global Climate Policy Director of the Sierra Club, here to talk about the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to start with this. In the lead up to Trump's decision to withdraw from the accord, there was a huge amount of mobilization and effort and energy put into giving him feedback and submitting comments to the White House to try to convince him to stay in the Paris Climate
Accord. Stay the course.
Stay the course, exactly. But in the end, of course, the decision didn't go that way. Was this surprising to you, or was this what you had anticipated?
Well, it's hard to be surprised by this administration at this point, and I feel like it's sort of a professional failing to admit that I was, but I was surprised by it. The overwhelming evidence was that this was going to be an unpopular decision in the U.S. and abroad, and you know, with CEOs, with every segment of the American population. There was a poll done that showed that leaving the Paris Agreement was unpopular in every single state, and a majority of Republicans opposed leaving the agreement. In fact, we did a call alert to our members, and 50,000 of our members called the White House the day before to ask him not to leave, by far the highest response we've ever had. So I really thought that in the end they would realize that this was just a bad decision and not do it. But obviously they made a different decision for, I think, a very different set of reasons.
Now, before we dig into this too deep, I suppose I should ask you to just kind of recap what our commitment was in the Paris Climate Accord and what we had committed to by being part of it.
Right. So there are sort of two sets of commitments in the agreement. There's the set of binding commitments, which are reporting commitments, that we'll tell the world what our emissions are, that we'll submit to certain verification rules that are not yet set, and that we'll, you know, be transparent in that effort and allow other countries to review our emissions. These are all things that the United States already does. We have a very transparent system of accounting for our greenhouse gas emissions that's done by multiple agencies of the federal government, and we have been working with other countries to help them create similar systems. So that was the piece that people talk about as being binding. And frankly, that was mostly the U.S. trying to get other countries to agree to a binding set of verification systems. It was never something that the U.S. was at all concerned about having to do itself. And then the other piece is these nationally determined contributions, as we call them, which are just sets of targets. These are what the countries agreed to do, and this is part of a voluntary system. And it was set up that way mostly because there was concern that if it wasn't voluntary, countries wouldn't be ambitious. They would only submit what they knew that they could do, and that wouldn't add up, and we needed a system that drove more ambition. So that's how this was established. And the U.S. said that we would reduce our emissions 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025, and that we would reevaluate and put a 2030 target on the table sort of around 2019. So that's where we are right now. That's what's basically on hold. And, you know, as the U.S. under this administration walks back its climate policies, it's getting harder and harder to meet that target.
Okay. John, this announcement was made probably, what, 2-3 weeks ago at this point. What has been the response, let's say, from the international community? What have other countries been saying about this?
So the international response was overwhelming, and it was entirely negative. There are basically no statements of support from any country or any group of countries, and I've never seen anything like it on the environmental side. That heads of state, the European Union and China issued a joint statement the next day saying that they confirm their commitments under the historic 2015 Paris Agreement. France, Italy, and Germany issued a joint statement. Before this, the G7 issued a statement that was a G6 statement saying that they'd go forward. The United Nations Secretary General, the least developed countries, the Pope. I mean, the scale of the condemnation was kind of amazing. And most expressed a combination of disappointment, anger, and frustration. But a lot of countries also were very clear that they would move on without the U.S. And some countries, I think, are happy to have the leadership space that the U.S. had previously occupied, particularly the EU and China.
Well, I was going to ask about China and India, two big players here, two big contributors to carbon emissions. What is their response? Are they saying, hey, if the U.S. isn't involved, we're not going to be involved?
Yeah, they said, China basically said they will continue to uphold their commitments to the Paris Agreement. And China has also been adding additional, you wouldn't describe them as requirements, but they've been moving past their commitment already and looking to new areas to establish programs that would move China further than what they pledged. China pledged that their emissions would peak, and the primary driver of emissions in China was coal. Coal use in China has been declining for 3 years now. So, I mean, they have other challenges with the auto sector and elsewhere to actually peak their emissions. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that they're going to achieve that goal ahead of schedule for a bunch of national reasons. And China is clearly going to be the big winner in the the sort of global leadership on clean energy as a result of the U.S. walking away.
Yeah.
So talk about some of those other countries or groups that you see taking on leadership in this area in the absence of U.S. participation. Who else do you expect to see sort of stepping up and leading the way?
Well, I think the EU for sure, and Germany in particular, and actually the new head of France, I think Germany and France are definitely going to be leaders. The French have been convening people since this announcement was made and hosting events and elevating the voices of individuals and companies and states that want to go further. The other party that I think is more surprising is India. Prime Minister Modi is a big advocate of solar. He basically ran for election on this notion that he would provide electricity access for all of his people using solar. And he's moved that forward surprisingly quickly since the election. There's been a huge build-out of solar facilities and some wind as well. And you see him stepping up. He didn't say anything directly about Paris in his joint statement with the president, but it's clear that he's going to continue to move forward. He's created this International Solar Alliance and done a bunch of other things that I think you'll see, a lot of countries that have issues providing access to electricity following his lead.
Yeah. But at the same time, India just has a tremendous infrastructure challenge just with getting electricity to hundreds of millions, literally billions of people. And so coal, it plays a big role in that solving. And so he's trying to do his best with renewables. But at the end of the day, coal will continue to play a role in India's infrastructure energy growth.
It's an interesting thing, though. So that was the consensus. And 2 years ago, the government of India was pushing the U.S. to finance their coal build-out.
Yeah.
And they've basically stopped their coal build-out. I mean, there's still a bunch of plants under construction.
Right.
But the Indian government said recently that they're not going to build any new coal plants after this phase. They didn't believe they were necessary. They just announced the closure of 37 mines. One of the big coal plants that got international financing, this Tata plant, is now up for sale because it's been such a financial albatross. So I think you see in India a sort of combination of the expense of coal, the relative cheapness of renewable energy, and the just colossal air quality problem that they have in India coming together and really causing the end of the coal build-out and a just kind of amazingly quick switch to renewable energy. I mean, not saying coal is going away in India.
Right.
Just saying that they're moving much more quickly than the U.S. did beyond coal.
Right. Okay.
So obviously the U.S. is kind of, assuming things continue to go as they are now, is really kind of falling behind in this space. So what does this mean for the U.S. economically? Like, what are the ramifications in that area?
Well, we believe that the transition away from coal to clean energy will continue under Trump, and frankly, so does Trump. And you hear their administration saying things that are, very contradictory in this space. But I think the biggest challenge to the U.S. is on the diplomatic side. But domestically, we now have an administration that seems to be really focused on fossil fuel development and not focused on the renewable energy development that is creating jobs in the U.S. right now at a really wonderful pace. And to me, that's the question going forward is, will they actually do things to derail that job creation engine? Right now there are twice as many solar jobs in the U.S. as there are coal jobs. That will continue to, that gap will grow over time. But the administration seems to be doing things to slow it down. And that's, really unfortunate and could result in the U.S. Losing out internationally on, the sort of race for clean energy jobs.
Hmm.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with John Coquette, the Global Climate Policy Director of the Sierra Club, about the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. So you mentioned that, you know, a lot of this renewable development is continuing, of course, with or without the Paris Climate Accord. And then we see sources, you know, like Bloomberg in his new book talks about how they anticipate that we'll meet the U.S. commitments anyway, regardless of what our federal government is doing, because there's so much action on local levels, right, and with municipalities and cities. So what are you seeing in that area right now?
Well, in order for that statement to be true, the progress that we've seen over the last few years, and we've seen tremendous progress moving away from coal. 250 coal plants have closed or are scheduled to close, sort of a combination. And, you know, we've seen this huge ramp up in renewables. But in order to meet the Paris target, that those retirements have to continue and the pace of renewable energy adoption has to quicken. And, you know, we believe that that's possible, just like Mr. Bloomberg, but it's definitely not a done deal. And meeting these targets is going to be difficult. It's always been a challenge that it was established as a target intentionally to drive ambition by the president. And, you know, without the federal government as a full partner, it's going to be more challenging.
Well, we've been talking a lot about coal. Let's talk about the other two elements of the fossil fuel industry, oil, natural gas. How does the pullout from the Paris Climate Accords impact those industries? Basically, it sounds like a lot of those industries, the members of those industries, supported U.S. involvement in the Climate Accords.
Yeah, basically all of the publicly held energy companies supported staying in the Paris Agreement. So, you know, even Peabody Energy, ExxonMobil, Shell, all of those big publicly owned fossil fuel companies supported. But where you had opposition was the privately held, mostly coal companies like Murray Energy.
That's Utah-based Murray Energy. Sorry, John. That's Utah-based Murray Energy.
We'll take credit for that.
Oh, sorry. Yes, well.
We're number one.
Yeah.
But before you go any further, why did oil industries, or why do oil industries support the Paris Climate Accords? What's in it for them?
Well, I think they believe that they need to have a rational regulatory system that they can understand and do business under. Mm-hmm. And they see the phase out that's coming, and they want to participate in that, and they want it to be global. They want it to be fair across countries, and they believe that the Paris Agreement established that framework. And the fact that it has, you know, regular updates, you know, allows them to be clear on what's coming, and the goals that are established are goals that they can work with, evidently. And they were okay with it. What we have instead is chaos in the administration. And frankly, they still don't have a clear climate policy, and they still aren't willing to say whether they even believe that it's a problem. So I think that was what they were looking to avoid. And I think the bigger issue is the car standards.
Right.
And there, it's there's a lot of concern that the auto industry is going to get caught in between, you know, the Paris Agreement and a desire to deregulate, and you're going to have chaos around the auto standards, and nobody seems to want that except the administration, and they just can't seem to get their plan straight.
So let's look domestically a little bit more. Which cities are leading the charge at this point? Our city and county, Park City and Summit County, where we're based, have both set, you know, goals, have climate plans. Who else around the country is kind of taking the lead with this, and how many cities have committed to, you know, these Paris, the Paris
type
guidelines or something similar?
Protocols or standards.
Yeah, there have been one of the most exciting things that happened in this sort of post-Paris moment was this We're Still In coalition. And since that happened, we've seen 100 cities stand up and say that they're ready to go to 100% renewable energy. That coalition is led by an interesting assortment of mayors that includes the mayor of Salt Lake and a number of others, and including San Diego, Miami Beach, Columbia, South Carolina. I mean, one of the interesting things about the mayor's initiative is that it's not particularly partisan. We have Republican mayors, we have Democratic mayors, we have mayors that are looking to save their residents money, and they're doing a really good job of that by committing to renewable energy contracts. And then you have, you know, mayors that have impacts that they are concerned about and are looking for ways to, you know, talk about this problem by joining the coalition. But that's been growing really quickly, and in fact, on Monday, the whole U.S. Council of Mayors endorsed this 100% idea. So we've been incredibly happy to see this, you know, quick adoption of the goal of getting to 100% renewable energy. I think where the challenge is going to be is implementing that at the city level. But we know that there's a lot that can be done, especially, you know, cities who have municipal power systems. But even more broadly, there are clear solutions that cities can push for.
And again, at the same time, the industry is seeming to embrace a bit more this idea of a carbon tax. Again, under the rubric of this being a consistent and uniform type of system that allows them to work more efficiently under, rather than having a patchwork of taxes that might be state-based or region-based or et cetera.
I think that's true, and it's particularly the large oil companies that support a carbon tax. I think because, frankly, even a fairly substantial carbon tax doesn't increase the cost of gasoline all that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they see it as a workable transition plan. It's a bigger deal for the coal industry that's already under incredible stress for a whole bunch of reasons. But you do see the carbon tax, you know, at least as a theory, picking up steam. So far, we haven't seen a whole lot of, you know, states adopt them. Some companies have adopted shadow carbon prices in their decision-making process.
Okay.
Well, we've only got about a minute left, John. And with that, I just want to give you a minute to talk about where our listeners can learn more about this, find more information, or get involved if they're interested.
Sure. You know, I think the biggest thing now is that this has just been a huge opportunity post this terrible decision to channel activism. At the Sierra Club, we have our Ready for 100 campaign. People should absolutely join that and push their local elected officials to move their communities towards clean energy. That's available at the Sierra Club website. And I think the other big thing, of course, is for people to go solar themselves. It's an easy thing that can be done in most communities. It saves you money over time. And if your house isn't shaded, it's a very cost-effective solution.
Right. And in addition, you know, they can continue to drive their fuel-efficient vehicles, which saves on oil, and better insulate their homes, which saves on natural gas. So there's a spectrum of things we can do, including just changing our consumptive behaviors, which
taking
we'll
the new electric bus.
New electric buses in town.
That's right.
So we're trying to do our part here in Park City, despite Utah's best efforts. Otherwise, we'll say it that way. So,
well, we're all jealous of you in Park City, especially this time of year in Washington, D.C.
Yes. Well, you're always welcome to come out here and do the next interview in studio. How about that, John?
Great.
Let us know. All right. John Coquette, and I apologize if we've mangled your name this whole interview, but John, he's the Global Climate Policy Director with Sierra Club. And John, thanks again for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Okay, anytime.
All right. Hey, let's take a break. for a couple of underwriters and sponsors. And we come back, we're going to be turning our attention to grizzly bears.
That's right.
The Yellowstone grizzly bears.
Mm-hmm.
And their recent announcement that by the Department of Interior that they're being delisted, removed from the Endangered Species Act. What that means, we'll talk with Matt Bishop from the WELC. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
There are many benefits of keeping weeds off your land. I'm Sterling Graham, proud supporter of KPCW and owner of Ground Solutions, a local company focused on weed abatement. Ground Solutions offers land management to commercial, residential, state, HOAs, and ranchers. More information at 659-9896 or groundsolutionsutah.com.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is Matt Bishop. He is with the Western Environmental Law Center, and he's here to talk about Yellowstone grizzly bears. Yellowstone grizzly bears, because last week the Department of Interior decided to remove Yellowstone grizzly bears from the Endangered Species Act, or remove them as in delist them as endangered species. And I'll let Matt share the rest. Thanks again for joining us this morning, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, let's get a start with some background. Why and when were these bears first put on the endangered species list?
Well, grizzly bears in the entire lower 48. Contiguous United States were listed as a threatened species back in 1975. Historically, when in the early 1800s, when Lewis and Clark came west, there were about 50,000 to 75,000 bears in the lower 48. But by the mid-70s, that number had dropped to well below 1,500 bears. And their historic range has shrunk by 98%. So today, they're actually only occupy about 2% of their historic range in the lower 48, just a few pockets of occupied habitat. And there are approximately 1,700 bears, by best guess, in the lower 48, so a very small percentage of what was there historically. So they were listed in 1975 as one entity in the lower 48. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's current proposal is to delist just one subpopulation, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem population, from the Endangered Species Act protections. The other populations will remain protected, but I know there are plans in place to also delist the Northern Continental Divide population, which is up near Glacier Park in the Bob Marshall Wilderness in northern Montana, in the next few years as well.
Okay. Well, I want to go back. You said something that is amazing. There were used to be somewhere between 50 and 75,000 grizzly bears in the lower 48, and that covered an area from everything from California along the entire West Coast east to Wisconsin, Minnesota, that geographic landscape?
Well, not that far east. The historic range, actually, the grizzly bear extended from as far south as northern Mexico, so southern Arizona, southern New Mexico, down in the Gila area, and as far north as the Colorado boundary. Obviously, throughout the Sierras, parts of the Cascades in Oregon and Washington. You know, it's on the California flag. Throughout Colorado, Wyoming, Utah as well.
Yeah, they were here.
But not as Then that's about it. Went out to the plains, but not really beyond Nebraska.
Okay.
Oklahoma and that area.
But thousands and thousands of bears, and they were just extirpated by hunters and others who saw them as a nuisance and a danger.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, really the same story that we see with other native carnivores of the West, you know, right. Canadian lynx, wolverine, wolves, bears.
We don't take well to not being at the top of the food chain. If there's something
that is
an apex predator, it typically has to go in some or be managed in this way. So the bear population in the Yellowstone Park area went down to as low as 150, correct? And then it was put on the endangered species list?
Yeah, again, it was put on the list together with the other all grizzly bears in lower 48.
Okay.
But in 1975, they estimated the population to be about 150. But it gets tricky when you're talking about population numbers and trends because they use different models and methods for counting bears. And so sometimes it's apples and oranges.
Hmm.
So when the federal government talks about 150 bears in 1975, that was based on what's called the total minimum population estimate. It was basically how many female bears with cubs they could count and see. And so that was where the 150 number came from. They weren't developing models back then to estimate how many bears exist that they couldn't count and see. And that they do that today. Obviously, you can't count every bear that you see. I mean, there's other bears that you're not seeing that are on the landscape that are being that should be counted. But back in 75, with the 150 number, it's basically the total minimum population, how many bears they actually were able to count and see. The estimation now is about 700, but that's a total population. So it includes those you can count and see, plus these very complicated models they developed to account for bears you can't see, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Plus bears don't know boundaries, so they're wandering in and out of Yellowstone Park.
So yeah, and I think that's one of our real concerns with the proposed delisting is, you know, the states of Wyoming, Montana and Idaho already have plans, and Montana has draft regulations in place to allow trophy hunting of grizzly bears as soon as they leave the park boundary.
Mm.
And we think that's problematic, just given where the bears are now. I mean, they've done well, and we should celebrate the numbers and the increases, but we still think it's premature to be removing protections and to allow trophy hunting, particularly because the population remains isolated in the greater Yellowstone area.
Right.
You know, the plans initially were to try to reconnect Yellowstone bears with the bears up in the Northern Continental Divide, and they're getting close, and also to reintroduce bears in the Salmon Selway in Idaho, the Bitterroot, where they were historically occurred. But the feds pulled the plug on the reintroduction plans, largely for political reasons. Idaho didn't want them. And we don't have dispersal and connection between the Northern Continental Divide and greater Yellowstone population, and we're not going to allow that dispersal to happen because the bears that wander out of the park and the ones that really we need to be dispersing will now be subject to hunting. So they're actually, we think it's a step in the wrong direction, and we think we're going to put back conservation efforts by decades. So they're doing well in some ways. The population's increasing, but it's still isolated. And what the best available science is telling us is we're seeing increased grizzly bear dispersal out of Yellowstone, but we don't know precisely why that is. The feds and the government will tell you because it's overcrowding,
right,
that they've reached their carrying capacity in the park. But the biologists and the scientists are saying, well, we're not so sure. The population has remained largely stable over the last 10 years. In the last 2 years, it's dipped. Meanwhile, dispersal has increased, and they've lost two of their main four food sources inside the park, white bark pine and cutthroat trout. So they might be moving out of the park to be looking for more food. In particular, there's these cutworm moss sites that are just outside the park. It's a very important food source for grizzly bears. So we're seeing them congregate in those areas. And unfortunately, when there's less pine seeds to eat and less fish, you know, they're looking towards more meat, you know, elk, bison, but also, unfortunately, that means livestock. So we have a lot of livestock activity southeast of the park, and we're seeing a lot more conflicts now.
Mm.
So I guess the point I'm trying to make is, yes, there's more dispersal, but we're not 100% sure why that is. It could be because they're hungry and looking for more food, not because it's crowded.
Right.
And we think in the face of that uncertainty, you know, let's not open up a season on grizzly bears leaving the park. Let's maybe wait 10, 15 years and figure out what's going on,
okay,
especially with the climate change impacts we're seeing in the park.
Right.
So is there a threshold, you know, looking forward, say that, well, these will be delisted, and then there's, you know, people hunting right around the edges of the park, and the population, you know, I can see it immediately dipping back down. Is there a threshold at which this will be relisted? Is this just kind of going to, you know, do you see this being a cycle back and forth?
Well, that's the concern. I mean, I think the federal government is proposing numbers. So if the population drops, again, imprecise methods too, you don't really know. Sometimes there's a lag effect. But basically they're saying if the population drops below 600, they won't allow hunting anymore. And they want to try to manage the population above 500. If it goes below 500, that might be a trigger for relisting. But again, we think those numbers are way too low.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of a single, and I'm not a biologist or a scientist, just, you know, as a disclosure, I'm a lawyer.
Right.
But I'm not aware, having looked through some of the science and trying to understand the decision, of a single peer-reviewed published paper that would suggest an isolated population of 700 bears, let alone 500 or 600, is recovered. I just haven't seen it yet because it's isolated. The level of extinction rate for an isolated population like that is, I think, it's well beyond what we'd want to see for this population. So why remove protections and subject them to even more human-caused mortality when it's still isolated, relatively smaller numbers, and we want to see it grow and disperse? And I think that's what they're keeping from happening.
We're speaking with Matt Bishop. He is a staff attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center. Matt, are you based out of Montana?
Yeah, so the organization is, we're basically a law firm for the conservation community. So we're our own 501c3. We're headquartered in Eugene, Oregon, and we teach an environmental law clinic at the University of Oregon School of Law. But we have offices in the Southwest, in Taos, New Mexico, in the Northern Rockies offices in Helena, Montana, which is my hometown. And we also have an office in Seattle.
Oh, okay. And I think you touched on this, but if the Yellowstone grizzly bear is going to be delisted, what kind of harbinger does that bring with bears in other parts of the lower 48? What's the risk?
I think
there?
this is going to be the new trend, and we think it's dangerous to
yeah.
be and counterproductive to be delisting these. It's like a piecemeal delisting of subpopulations when they should be managing for recovery and moving towards recovery for the entire lower 48 population. But I do think it means this is the step they want to take. They want to hand over wildlife management back to the states. So here in Montana, I think we're going to see a proposal to delist the Northern Continental Divide population probably in the next few years. The other isolated populations are not doing as well. That's up in the Cabinet Yak and the Selkirk population up in northwest Montana in the very tip of the Idaho Panhandle. In fact, the Cabinet Yak population is down to about 40. So I don't foresee that happening. But again, I think we don't like this piecemeal process of just delisting subpopulations. We think they should be managed as a larger metapopulation in the lower 48. And the goal and effort should be put on increasing connectivity and linkage areas for those subpopulations. And then once we did that, then talk about delisting. Because that's the ultimate goal, is recovery.
I think
you would share that goal. I just think it's premature right now. You know, we think they're jumping the gun with respect to the Yellowstone population.
Well, along those lines, what is, you know, the motivation to make this happen right now? Of course, there are always folks that, as we've discussed, don't want to see those predators in their areas. But what's the motivation to take this on right now and delist the grizzly as soon as possible?
You know, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer to it. It's hard to say. You know, this process actually got started a few years ago. And, you know, even last year under the Obama administration, they issued a proposed rule. So things were moving forward. I do think there is a lot of pressure to return wildlife management to the states, these western states in particular. They're really not happy about, they don't like federally listed species and the federal control and additional requirements that come with them. So there's been a huge effort. In fact, I can't speak for Utah, but in Montana, I know the state's never supported a single listing, regardless of the numbers or the science. They've come out in opposition of every federal listing in Montana. And so this is part of it. They want to manage it. You know, I'm not so sure. I think there is some economic incentive. You know, Montana is proposing to sell out-of-state hunting licenses for $1,000 a piece.
Right.
Wow.
I'm not suggesting that that's the motivator necessarily, but these state game agencies certainly benefit financially from having hunting seasons for certain species.
And I wanted to go back to a statement you made that back around 1975, when the bear was listed, there was about 150 bears or so, plus or minus. What efforts were put in place to increase that population? What did they do to benefit the bear population?
Well, what they did was they stopped allowing recreational hunting, number one. Mm. Second, they put in place a lot of the bear habitat in Montana and around Yellowstone is on national forest lands. So they did develop forest plan standards to protect and conserve grizzly bear habitat, in particular like decreasing road density and restricting some logging projects in certain areas. The biggest threat for bears is the human conflict interaction. Most bears are killed by getting in trouble with humans or interacting with humans, hunters, highways, things like that. So the more secure remote habitat, the better. And they've done a decent job of protecting that and managing that habitat in and around Yellowstone Park.
And these classic images I used to see when I was little on Disney about people feeding bears and seeing how close they get to bears.
Watching the bears at the dump.
That has gone away too.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I think that's a significant change. You know, they used to have those garbage sites where people would go take pictures of bears. And so now that's, you know, these food storage orders are in place where you have to carefully manage food at campsites and in residential communities around there. And that's really helped to benefit or minimize the human interactions with bears. Again, that's always been the goal.
So looking forward, what are the, you know, plans of the Western Environmental Law Center and the partner organizations you work with this delisting? What's happening now?
Well, you know, we're actually in the process of reviewing the final rule. It actually hasn't been published in the Federal Register, so it doesn't take effect until 30 days after it's published in the Federal Register, but it is available online at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's website. So we're reviewing it carefully right now. And the next step for us is, we're anticipating we're going to legally challenge the rule on behalf of a group called Wild Earth Guardians. We anticipate filing, under the law, you have to file a 6-day notice letter outlining the legal concerns and complaints, and you give the agency an opportunity to review those and if they would like to sit down and discuss them. But assuming they don't respond, then we'll file a federal lawsuit in district court on day 61. We anticipate that there will be some tribal entities also challenging the rule, as well as other conservation groups. And we also anticipate the states of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho coming in to intervene to defend the rule, along with other industry folks as well. So it will be a huge case. It will be a difficult case. And in some ways, you know, there's a lot of deference to federal agencies on scientific issues. But if they've really... they took some shortcuts and didn't take a close look, for instance, at why grizzly bears are dispersing and some of the uncertainty, then there is potential to really to force a remand of the decision, to vacate the decision and send it back to the agency. Under the law, the agency has to apply the best available science, and so that becomes a focal point of the court's analysis.
And something similar happened in 2007, right? There was an effort to delist the grizzly bear, but because of... you know, some of the details you were talking about with the white bark pine and other impacts, it wasn't successful.
Yeah, so this is the second round. It's going back, and they've gone back and taken a closer look at the white bark pine issues. But, you know, a lot's changed since then. There's also been a lot of new scientific papers. And so, again, that will be, you know, another... the court would be taking a close look at that particular... the scientific issues. There's also this other legal issue as to whether or not the agency can simultaneously create what's called a distinct population segment, or DPS, in the Yellowstone area and delist it at the same time. We don't think legally they can do that under the statute, the Endangered Species Act. So you can't So under the Endangered Species Act, you can list a species, a subspecies, or what's called a DPS, a distinct population segment. What they did with the Yellowstone population is they created a separate DPS, but solely for the purposes of delisting it. But in order to delist something, it has to be listed first. At least that's going to be our contention. So we feel like we have a fairly strong legal claim up front that they can't create a population segment solely for the purposes of delisting. That's inconsistent with the statute.
Hmm. Okay.
But we'll see how that plays out.
Right. And when you say the court, where does this all occur? And is this a three judge panel, or is this a single judge that would make the final decision?
Well, the case will likely be filed in federal district court in Montana. That's where most of the plaintiff groups are, and that's where the decision's being made. So it will be heard by district court, and you're right, eventually it will probably go up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and that's a three-judge panel. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. I mean, there's
right.
a lot to happen. You know, we have to do the 60-day notice. And it might be, you know, if the states, it depends on the timing, but if the states are eager to get hunting regulations on the book and to allow a trophy hunting season this summer or fall, then after we file the case, you know, we'll be very busy trying to move for injunctive relief to stop that, which is what we anticipate we'll have to do.
Okay. In any case, it sounds like the actual event won't occur until these court cases are heard and tried.
Well, that's my hope. I mean, it depends on, it's going to be up to the states. The grizzly bear will officially be delisted 30 days after the rules published in the Federal Register. We won't have to move for injunctive relief unless the states decide to move forward with the hunting season. That's something that, you know, my clients just won't sit back and watch happen. You know, the trophy hunting as bears leave the park. So we'll have to move for injunctive relief. My hope, however, is that everybody will take a time out. We'll just preserve the status quo and give the court a chance to really hear the arguments in the case and make a decision before states move ahead with the hunting season.
Okay, man, we got to wrap up. Where do people go to learn more about this issue and also the work that the Western Environmental Law Center does on other species?
Well, you can visit our website online. It's the www.westernlaw.org.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want more information on the Yellowstone grizzly bear situation, there is a federal website dedicated. I don't have that website handy, but it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grizzly bear page.
Mm-hmm.
If you just did a keyword search online, you could find it.
Okay, great. Well, Matt, we sure appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning about this important issue. And I think we're going to be getting back in touch with you to stay on top of this as it progresses
sure.
about this and other species that are also at threat with respect to delisting possibilities. So thanks.
Yeah, well, thanks for your interest.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch.
Great.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we've got a couple of news items and a calendar event or so to throw in.
Of course.
You bet. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And a few weeks ago, well, probably a few months ago now, Chris and I spent some time talking about the plastic bag ban that's now in effect here in Park City.
Just went into effect.
That's right.
Just a day or so ago.
And Chris, you're a resident here of the city of Park City. And you've done a little informal surveying.
Well, very informal. Let's be upfront about this. This is
all right. Really, you spoke with one person at the grocery store.
I went to the supermarket yesterday. I went to the market, and But I had an interesting conversation with the cashier, because you really want to know what's going on with issues. Talk to the cashier. Don't talk to the manager. Don't talk to those who support it. Or,
cashiers are on the front lines.
Because they're on the front line with this issue. And they're fielding all the questions. And with this one cashier I spoke to, I said, so how's that bag ban going? He said, it's not good. And he wasn't happy, basically, because people... A lot of people weren't aware that the ban was going into effect. And to be fair, it was interesting because at least at the market, there was no real signs posted saying that this ban was going to go into effect.
Right, when this, it was is a city policy.
This is a city policy. This is a city policy. Get ready, beware. There was one little 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper on the window as I came in that just asked the question, did you remember your reusable bag? Well, no, but I'm sure I'll be able to get it back. You have bags, don't you? Well, a lot of people are a little disappointed that all of a sudden they walk in there without a reusable bag, thinking they'll get a plastic bag. And no, there's no plastic bag, but there is paper bags.
Right, there are paper bags.
All right, no problem. But the market is charging 10 cents for each paper bag.
It's more expensive for them.
That's right, it is. Paper bags are more expensive. We were aware of that. And so they're charging a fee for that. And so people aren't too crazy about that. So now they have 3 or 4 paper bags, and that's additional 40 cents, 30 or 40 cents. And I saw some people just walking out with 3 or 4 items, juggling them and holding them in their hands.
Absolutely. I say, why not?
That's what you do.
Yeah. If I forget a bag and I have a handful of items, I'll just take them loose out to my car.
Right. So, again, this is just my little single experience. I'd be curious to hear what others are experiencing. I have my reusable bag, and I went in and bought my usual 4 items because I can't buy more than 4 items. I'm terrible. But that's the ban is in effect. And boy, July 4th weekend's coming up, and there's going to be a lot of people who show up at the store without reusable bags. So,
well, it's that learning curve, right? It's a brand new policy. Everybody's going to have to learn about it. Those people who, maybe aren't from this area or haven't been listening to KPCW.
It's called adaptation.
May not know, that this is in place yet. So it'll be interesting to see, in a year what this is like,
in
right?
In a year, right. So we'll be sharing. I'm sure we'll be speaking with others who have shared their experiences with how things are going. we'll be
Perfect.
Sure to report that. All right, we got 2 more minutes. Any quick calendar of event you want to share?
Oh, there's always stuff coming up. One thing I'm going to mention is the Master Naturalist course at Swanner that we'll be teaching July 10th to 14th. It's a 40-hour course, so all day, each day. Great for educators or teachers, but most of the students are usually just folks interested in learning about the natural world around us. So you'll learn all about the watersheds and water quality and the plants and the wildlife in this area. It's a lot of fun, and you can register at swannerecocenter.org. And we have, I think, a couple of spots left at this point, a handful of spots. So if you're interested, hop on there and reserve your spot sooner rather than later. Yeah.
All right. Perfect. Let's wrap up this episode of This Green Earth.
We want to thank our sponsors and our underwriters who make the show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course listeners like you.
You can always email us your thoughts, your comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. We would love to hear from you.
Yes, with thoughts and ideas for who you want us to talk to. Remember,
that's right.
This is your show.
Do you have questions about an issue? Let us know that, and we can find the right person.
All right. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. Remember, we've got your Wasatch back. NPR News is coming up.